Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Thomas of the Physical Attraction podcast, and we're going to be talking about Frederick Pohl's Gateway, winner of the 1978 Hugo Award. So, Thomas, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much.
I guess I want to start by talking a little bit about your podcast and some of your background as well. So do you want to just jump right in and talk about physical attraction and talk about, I'm sure, kind of your background feeds into what you're doing?
Sure, absolutely. So I am a physics student at the University of Oxford. I finished my undergrad last year and I've now started a DPhil, which is the silly Oxford term for a PhD. That's what it is, atmospheric and climate physics. And I host this podcast, Physical Attraction, which was basically my idea to explain physics with a series of geeky, jokey kind of physics-based pickup lines that I'd come up with for a speech that I did a few years earlier. And so I've been doing this show where I explain different topics in physics every week. And because I tend to go on tangents, it's currently on a massive series about all the various apocalypses and existential threats that we might face as human beings in the future. I'm really enjoying it. Podcasting is an amazing hobby to have. So that's a lot of fun. And I guess it's about as geeky as I can imagine being, doing a show that's, you know, about physics and interviewing scientists and so on. But one of the main reasons I got into physics and decided to study physics was because of having read so much sci-fi as a kid. And that's why I was really excited to come on this show and talk about Gateway, which is one of my favorite books I remember reading from that time.
Nice. Now, I've talked to several of my guests, and people kind of have different, sorry for the pun, gateway drugs to science fiction. Some, you know, television and movies, and some more books. Where would you say you fall in there, or is it all of the above?
So I would say that definitely, well, it's interesting. There's a bit of a mix. So I was 10 years old when Doctor Who came back onto British TV, and my dad was a huge fan of the old classic Doctor Who. And I remember we were on holiday in some caravan somewhere, and we had a TV. And he said, "There's this show on that I think you're going to enjoy." And it was the first episode of the revival of Doctor Who. And I remember watching that and just being blown away by it, as I'm sure a lot of people were. And that was part of it. But I'd been reading sci-fi for a long time before that. And I remember reading a lot of the Sci-Fi Masterworks series as a teenager. And, you know, whenever you'd find a new one in the shops, that would be a pretty good day. And so I think it was a mix of both, really, that got me into them. I was never a big Star Trek fan or anything like that, because I guess that is a gateway drug for a lot of people, you'd say.
Yeah.
How about you?
It totally was for me. So
yeah.
Yeah. Star Trek and Star Wars were big for me. I was born in the 70s, and so kind of grew up with the original Star Wars trilogy and original Trek in syndication. So, and then Star Trek The Next Generation came out when I was in 7th or 8th grade. So that was a big thing for me, and I wasn't much of a reader, and that's kind of why I'm doing this podcast now, to try and kind of cover more of these, since I'm a science fiction fan, to cover more of these classics of the genre.
Absolutely. It's a really great way to get through them all, because, you know, the Hugos have consistently been, if they don't introduce you to the best work of an author, they always introduce you to the authors that are worth knowing, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And I like doing it where I'm just able to ask somebody, hey, pick one that you like or that you really want to read, and kind of bring the enthusiasm in from that angle, rather than just trying to slog through everything in order.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Yeah.
And so, talking of Hugo winners, and you mentioned you were a pretty big reader. Did you tally up how many of the Hugo winners you've read?
Yes. So I saw this, and I went onto the website and started adding them up. And I think I've read 16 of them.
Okay.
If you quiz me on all of them, I couldn't tell you the exact plot lines for some of them. And there was somewhere I'd read the nominees, or I looked at it and thought, I've read others by the same author but hadn't read them. But yeah, right. That's my tally. And it makes me think, wow, I should probably read the rest.
Well, you can always follow along and check out my back catalog and
yeah,
see
absolutely.
If any of those
it's
are
good
new
idea.
For you. So, I am now at 20. I think I started at either 12 or 13. So I think 7 of the episodes that I've done, and this will be, I think, number 11. Have been new reads for me. So that's exciting.
Okay, cool.
And that's why I'm doing it. So kind of non-spoiler discussion of this book. Why this book? Why did you choose it?
Okay, so should I talk about where I first heard about this novel and when I first got this novel? Because I think that's kind of part of my personal history with the title.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you have American listeners, they probably won't know about this, but there is a tiny village in Wales, which is part of the United Kingdom, called Hay-on-Wye. And the strange thing about Hay-on-Wye is that it is a book town. It was sort of declared a book town by the guy who ran it and owned it. He bought up a lot of property in the town and turned it into secondhand bookshops. And they even for a while had this gimmick where they had declared it an independent micronation. And so it was its own sort of state, and the guy owned a castle, and he declared himself the king of Hay-on-Wye. And so when I was a teenager, we used to go down there a lot for weekend breaks and things like that. And that was back when, you know, when you're that age, 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 pounds is about as big a sum of money as you can possibly imagine, right? Because it's, you know, think of all the sweets I could get with that kind of thing. So
exactly.
So I'd go there with like 50 pounds and go around the bookshops, the secondhand bookshops. There's this saying that there's more books than people there. And I don't know if that's true, but there probably is. And there's something like 50 secondhand bookshops at its peak in this one tiny village. And there was one that was just full of sci-fi books. And of course, when you go to a secondhand bookshop, it's always a bit of a mixed bag because some of the books are there because they belong to people's collections and, you know, they got rid of the whole collection. And some of them just are unloved, obscure titles. And in the sci-fi, there was such a variety, you know. There'd be some that was pulpy sci-fi from the 1950s and things that I don't know if anyone's ever read. And there's other stuff that I read that I didn't realize when I read it that it was a classic, if you see what I mean. I just picked up the stuff that looked good and had an interesting title. And so that was where I found Gateway. I got some really old, battered edition of it for about 50p, you know, probably about a dollar, I guess. And I read it and I was just blown away by it. I thought, the thing about this book is, I think what it has is one of the most amazing premises of any sci-fi novel that I've ever read. And in fact, the premise is so good that if you don't read the book for a decade, you'll still remember the theme of it and still sort of want to be in that world with the excitement and the possibility. And I guess, well, we'll talk about the plot line of it in a second, but I think it's a lovely metaphor for being young and thinking, you know, I have all of these different paths and avenues in front of me. And so I guess there's a lot of nostalgia for me personally with this book. And you know, even rereading it just the other day, it's so lovely to remember the bookshops in Hay-on-Wye, and hopefully I get to go back there soon.
Yeah, that gives me something to add to my kind of bucket list for future tourism.
Yeah, if you ever come to the UK, definitely. It's a little out of the way, Hay-on-Wye, but it's so nice, and everyone who's there is, well, I mean, the kind of people who go to a town full of secondhand bookshops.
Right. Yeah, I was just looking it up while you were talking, and it looks terrific.
So. Yeah, they even had a bookshop in the castle for a while. I don't know if that's still there, but in the grounds of the castle, you could get secondhand books.
Cool. Well, continuing kind of the non-spoiler talk, do you want to talk a little bit about the plot?
Sure. So if I would summarize, again, this plot that I talked about. So it's a futuristic setting on Earth, but Earth is quite dystopian. Resources are horribly depleted, and our main character actually works in the strip mines, mining for shale gas, like fracking, I suppose. But the shale gas is not actually being used to power cars. It's to feed the population. The population is around 100 billion in this futuristic Earth, and so they are kind of growing bacteria on the shale gas. And so they've essentially devastated and ravage the Earth's ecosystem and countryside to support this huge overpopulation. So there's this kind of Malthusian fear there. And the one thing that is different about this futuristic world is that they've been to Venus, and they've discovered on Venus tunnels left behind by this mysterious civilization called the Heechee. And the Heechee have left behind these tunnels, and they left behind a spaceship. And that spaceship was used by the humans to go somewhere called Gateway. And Gateway is a sort of asteroid in the solar system that hadn't previously been detected, that was colonized by these Heechee for some reason. The Heechee are all gone. No one knows what happened to them, whether they're extinct, whether they've just vanished and mysteriously left all of their technology behind. And the main thing that they've left behind is hundreds of these ships, these alien ships. And they're very mysterious. You know, they're obviously designed for the aliens. No one can understand their language. No one can understand what they're for. But we figured out how to fly them. But there's a catch. We figured out how to fly them to random coordinates. We can change the coordinates, but we don't know where the ships are going. And so if you're flying on them, it's basically playing a game of space roulette, a game of Russian roulette. Mm-hmm. You could fly and you could end up in the middle of nowhere. You could fly and you could end up next to some stars and you'd get some astrophysical data back. You could fly and you end up, you know, in a supernova, or you land on a planet that is toxic to human life, or you land on a planet where there's nothing interesting, or you could fly and find some other remnants of the Hechi or other alien civilizations. And so people have gone out there and they've brought back unbelievable new technology, or they've discovered other worlds. And they're playing this sort of solar lottery. You know, you've got a very big chance of dying. You've got quite a big chance of finding nothing at all. And you just have this tiny chance of striking it rich and living like a king. Right. And because things are so desolate and desperate on Earth, everyone, I guess, is there on the teeming, huddled masses of Earth, a dreaming of making it to Gateway so that they can spin the dice and, you know, hopefully live a better life, but at a great risk as well.
Yeah, it reminds me of the California and the Alaska gold rushes.
Yes, that's a really good analogy.
Yeah, I'm actually from Alaska, and so we studied quite a bit about the Alaskan gold rush, and just the idea of people taking up and moving from the continental United States to Alaska in the 1800s is just bonkers. So,
and it's an equivalent, really, because people have to actually move to this asteroid Gateway, and you know they do so with their whole life savings, and they leave everything behind, like your gold rush people. I suppose the difference there is that if you failed in the gold rush, you would probably be bankrupt and desolate, perhaps, but you might not be eaten by ravenous aliens or anything like that.
Right? Yeah, just bears.
That's true. Actually, there's probably
and the typical over. You know, deprivation of that kind of thing, going someplace that's not necessarily desolate, but is at least unknown.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's a sense for us now in the modern world that, in some ways, there's not much exploration spirit left. And you know, you can't. It's not like it was in the 1700s, 1600s, 1500s, when, at least from a European perspective, you could, if you had that risk, sail off. And obviously this is how America was founded, you know, by people who were being persecuted in Europe, sailing for the Americas, taking the risks, what they will find there, who knows, could be riches, could be a better life, you know, could be death.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. And I think the point you brought up about it kind of reminding you of a younger time and kind of that younger excitement. And I get the impression you're quite a bit younger than I am. just based on when you said the new Doctor Who came back. because I remember that too. And I think I was probably 30. So, but yeah, that's an interesting thing where it has a nostalgia to it. When you read it, someone my age can look back and go, oh, I remember what it was like to be, you know, kind of young and excited and thinking that I had all these prospects. And then you kind of slowly stop taking adventures. I mean, not everyone does, but there's a tendency to settle.
Yes. But it's also not completely adventurous, because there's this very dark undertone of, you know, the main character, as we've mentioned a little bit, his name is Robinette Broadhead, which is one of these classically brilliant sci-fi names, and it comes up quite a lot that he's resentful of having a girl's name, Robinette. I've never met a Robinette, but apparently it's a real name. You know, he basically says, either I take this Russian roulette or I live a terrible, boring, dismal, depressing life working in the food mines, and, you know, there's no hope of improvement for me in any way. And it, you know, it's like that famous Tracy Chapman song, Fast Car. You have the choice to kind of try and leave the city and, you know, do you burn out or fade away? And I guess the way that people burn out here is heading off into the space and seeing what they find.
Right. Okay, so just any other overall thoughts before we get into spoilers?
Yeah, I think rereading this book, what I would say is that, because one of the major themes that we haven't mentioned is that it's half and half. So it's half a sort of memoir retelling by Robinette of his experiences on Gateway, prospecting, as they call it, which is going through space. Mm-hmm. And but the other half is his interactions with his robot psychotherapist, who is usually called Siegfried, or sometimes Siegfried von Schrink, which is another one of his little witticisms that Frederick Pohl likes to put in his work, I guess. And I certainly think that the aspects of the book that stand up more for me that I think are stronger are the prospecting series. And I think you can, if you take against the main character and don't like them, then the bits where they're being psychotherapized might run a little bit slower for you. But then again, if you're into, you know, therapy and psychoanalysis, and I think it's influenced a lot by the Freudian milieu that they were in at the time, I guess. And perhaps nowadays we would look at a lot of it as being quite dated, the psychotherapy aspects of it. You might look on that part differently, but I think it's the kind of book where, you know, 20, 30 years after reading it, you'll still remember that premise and think about, you know, I find myself thinking all the time, gosh, I wish I could go to Gateway, go on one of the ships and go on one of those adventures and see what would happen.
I feel like the kind of interstitial chapters with Siegfried kind of build up some anticipation for it. It makes you think, wait, something happened out there.
Yeah.
And eventually we're going to find out. Mm-hmm. And so really that anticipation builds up through the book. In fact, before I started reading the book, I think I was just searching for an ebook of it. And I came across an IO9 article where they were blogging the Hugos. They were reading through and blogging about them. Mm-hmm. And the title was Gateway, the Most Dreadful of the Hugo Winners. And I thought,
wow.
Oh, boy. You know, and I had seen you talk so highly about it. My friend Colin said, no, that's a really enjoyable read. And so I finally sat down and read the article today. And they're using dreadful in the kind of older form,
yes,
meaning to cause
dread. There's a
dread.
Lot of dread.
And that's a really good point. And that's kind of what I was talking about the fact that it really does build that anticipation and dread for, you know, what happened here. Something bad happened. Mm-hmm. But we can talk more about that when we get into
spoilers. Yeah, of course. But you're right. I mean, you're right to say that it does serve a purpose. What I would say, what I'm trying to say is that those are the aspects of the book that might feel dated. And I guess when we're talking about sci-fi, when was it written? Gosh, 1977. Yeah, 1977. Out. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's actually not as old as some of the Hugos, but I mean, you always expect there to be some datedness. And I would say that those are the aspects that people might see as differently nowadays. But in a lot of ways, it's very prescient too.
Sure. So in terms of recommending this novel, what if there were fans of other book series, television series, can you think of anything similar to Gateway?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure that I can. One of the things it does remind me of is something that's far less well-known than Gateway, but it's something that, do you know about you probably know the Animorph series, which was popular on TV, and they had a long series of books.
Sure.
And the author who wrote that wrote a series of books afterwards called Remnants, which was similarly about a group of humans who were... The Earth was post-apocalyptic and they were sent off into space and they landed on this strange planet and they just had to try and survive however they could. And I think there's a similar sense of exodus and pilgrimage, but it's not quite the same because it's not so much exploratory and taking a risk and so on. I can't think of anything quite like it. I will say that my favorite author was Philip K. Dick, and I love this book. So perhaps Philip K. Dick fans might enjoy it. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking about it. And one of the books that it reminded me of in some ways, and it might sound weird because it's a military science fiction book, and it's The Forever War.
Yeah.
And in there is kind of, there's a sense of inevitability for the main character because he keeps going out on deployment and thinking, okay, this is the time that where I'm going to buy it. You know, and yet he keeps surviving. And that some of that reminded me of kind of Bob's dread of actually going out, but knowing he needs to go out.
You're right. Yes, there's a very similar, I guess that would be familiar to a lot of military people, wouldn't it? Because, there's a great series of books I read that's not sci-fi, but I think it's Restoration, Pat Barker's Restoration trilogy about the First World War.
Hmm.
And, you know, the First World War, soldiers didn't spend all their time in the trenches. They went on rotations. And so... The Restoration, it tells you about his experiences in the trenches, but it also tells you about his experiences away from the trenches. And when you're not there, it's this strange feeling of, you know, I should be there, I should be fighting. That's where the action is. That's where life is. That's where the decisions get made and so on. And I guess maybe it is a feeling that's familiar for a lot of military people. And the parallels with the Forever War, I think, go a little bit deeper than that as well, because as you say, in the Forever War, one of the issues is they're fighting these... Is it insects they're fighting?
I can't remember the details now.
Yeah, I forget. They're fighting some alien civilization. But the thing is, because of relativity, which is a theme in Gateway as well, the exciting consequences of relativity in sci-fi, they never know who they're going to encounter on the other side because they're out of sync with the alien civilization that they're fighting. And I think that's very similar to Gateway because, again, you know, they press the button and they go on their voyage and there's all this anticipation against who we're going to be fighting against and who we won't be fighting against. And along with the sci-fi potential for relativity, I think those are two themes that the books share a lot.
Yeah, definitely. So it's a strong recommend from both of us, I think.
Mm-hmm. Certainly not the most dreadful Hugo winner.
No, not in that sense. And so I think it was just more of a clickbaity title.
Yeah, well, it certainly worked on us, didn't it?
Yeah. So why don't we go ahead and get into spoilers here? So, dear listener, if you haven't read this one, it's a quick read. You know, I read it in a couple of days. Thomas read it yesterday. So it's definitely one that's worth picking up.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. So we can just kind of start into freeform discussion. Anything that you want to talk about? I kind of wanted to talk about what you were just talking about, kind of jump off from that and about the kind of Russian roulette aspect of it.
Okay, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
because the one of the main concerns, of course, is you don't know how far your ship is going to go. You don't know how long the journey is going to take. And so there's that, again, dreadful anticipation of, have we started decelerating yet? And if we're not at the turnaround point before we're halfway through our rations, then we've got a big problem.
And, you know, there's a really moving scene in the book as well where they describe how that would happen. Say there's five, because these ships are divided into ones, threes, and fives. The ones can have one person, the threes can have about three people, and the fives can have five. And so if you're on, say, a three or five person ship, and so what happens is something on the ship glows blue or pink or whatever when you're a quarter of the way through your journey. Mm-hmm. So you spend your whole time waiting for that. And then, you know, you multiply it by four and you figure out whether you have enough rations or not.
Right. And figure out if you have any time to do any exploration on the other end.
Exactly. And so if you've got through 25% of your rations and the thing hasn't gone pink, well, then you know that if any of you are going to have a chance of surviving, one of you is going to have to stop consuming rations.
Right.
And so you're stuck in this situation where people are, you know, drawing cards and things to commit suicide or voluntarily killing themselves. And one of the things we didn't mention in the non-spoiler discussion, but I think is a real highlight of this book, is throughout it's peppered with documentation. Mm-hmm. So every few pages, there'll be a document which will be something related to Gateway, like the Gateway Authority will have it, or quite often they have reports from previous missions. Mm-hmm. And it's just a brilliant way, I think, that the author has of world building and bringing in a constant sense of what this world's like by giving you snippets of it. It makes you feel like there's a much bigger thing there.
And yes, definitely.
If Frederick Pollard wanted to put all of these people's stories in with just characters talking to each other and saying, you know, did you hear about Steve? He went to Planet Nine and got blown up. It wouldn't be nearly as effective.
Yeah.
But the mechanism of having the documents, and they have people on Earth talking about the Heechee, there's a series of lectures from a professor and so on. It's a brilliantly sly bit of writing from Pol, because he can put in stuff that's necessary for the plot later. He can remind you constantly of the risk and of other characters and so on. And sometimes it's just amusing, you know, it breaks up the text. So I'd forgotten about that being in there, actually, until I reread it. And I think that's really an excellent device that he uses.
Yeah, I enjoyed that as well. Mm-hmm. And even just I don't think it was every single chapter that there was an interstitial with Siegfried, but I thought there were a couple places where it just continued the narrative. But for the most part, it's, you know, half and half. Psychotherapy sessions and actual, here's what happened.
That's right.
And you do, like I said earlier, you do find out things about Bob, Robinette, Robin, mm-hmm. Robbie,
depending on how Siegfried feels. Yes.
Yeah. I was proud of myself for picking that up before it was actually explicitly called out.
Yes,
by Bob.
It's this idea that he calls him by different names based on, you know, it's very strange. This idea of calling people by their name when you talk to them. It's a very powerful tool that I don't think people do a lot in conversation. But I always certainly feel a certain rush when someone uses my name in conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think I can imagine you doing it with a psychotherapist. I've never been analyzed like that. But I think if you did, it would be very interesting. And so I can sort of see that as a technique would work, because Siegfried says he uses it to try and manipulate Bob's psychology when he's discussing the events of his life in Gateway.
Right. Or is he trying to manipulate it, or is he reacting to actually Bob's mental state? There's kind of a dichotomy there.
Yeah, or even just telling Bob, this is what your mental state is, take that into account, in a sense.
Sure.
And, of course, the thing with Bob is that it becomes clear very early on that he is fantastically wealthy.
Yes.
So you know that he has succeeded in his prospecting mission. At some point, he's found something that has made him a millionaire, and he talks about living this incredibly luxurious life. And yet you get a sense that he's deeply unhappy. And
yes.
He hates going to see this robot psychotherapist, and, you know, he can't stand it. But
yeah.
He still feels the need to, and they're sort of in this strange relationship that is very well explored, actually, the relationship between Siegfried and Bob. What did you think about it?
Yeah, I thought it was fascinating, too, because it's almost familial mm-hmm. in some ways. It's like he's talking to a relative. And yeah, you don't know immediately that it's voluntary, that he's there on his own volition. He's not being forced to do it.
That's right.
Other topics?
So, I mean, the other interesting thing, I think, is this concept of a robot psychotherapist, because we are starting to live in a world now where we are getting chatbots and algorithms that are beginning to become slightly more convincing than they used to be, shall we say, especially with this new AI advent and so on. Actually, I did a podcast. I don't want to plug my own show too much. I did a podcast called Seduced by a Robot, which was all about the attempts by these Japanese researchers to produce a robot that would give you love advice. And it would go through huge forums of human-based love advice and sort of mash together some sentences for you. And that wasn't particularly convincing. But there's this sense that Bob has throughout the time when he's talking to Siegfried, where he's saying, you're just a machine. You don't understand my emotions. How could you possibly get it? Because even though you're a super advanced machine with he-chi circuits, as they like to say, this alien technology in the psychotherapist, how could you know how I feel? And it almost renders, you think that in some ways the ideal psychotherapist is emotionless. My stepdad is a counselor. And he deals with lots of people who've had very serious issues in their life. And he says, what you need most of all is emotional detachment. And he normally tells me, that's why you can never do this job. And I agree with him, because if someone was telling me about, you know, how the terrible things that have happened in their life, I'd probably just start crying. And that's not what you want at all. So in a sense, you know that the robot is going to be detached and impartial and emotionless. And in some ways, you might think that's good for a psychotherapist. But is it? Do you want them to have some empathy? I mean, that I think is a very interesting theme, and whether he can relate to Siegfried properly, knowing that he's a robot, or whether that always gets between them.
Yeah, that is cool. So, I mean, since I have a physics major here, or science major, and you said your undergraduate degree was in physics, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And now you're doing a more focused topic for your doctorate.
Yeah, yeah.
So I did want to talk about some of the scientific aspects of the book.
Sure, absolutely.
One thing that stuck out to me was I thought he never really went into any possible ill effects of living for prolonged periods in low gravity.
Mm-hmm.
Because Gateway is microgravity, right?
That's right. And they do occasionally mention that. They talk about how easy it is to carry things and so on.
Yeah. I imagine you'd have a lot of accidents from people who first were there, because they'd find that, oh, wow, these things are so easy to lift, and forget about things like inertia and momentum and, you know, get somebody pinned to a wall by a rogue suitcase or something that came flying at them, because it still has mass, of course.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's an awful lot of willing suspension of scientific disbelief in this book.
Sure.
For example, as we'll probably come on to talk about in a minute, one of the main topics does revolve around gravitational time dilation and the time effects of heavy gravity fields, which was recently explored for a lot of people who probably saw it in Interstellar. And, you know, is scientific. But it also has faster than light travel, because the He-Chi ships, by some mechanism that is obviously never explained, can travel faster than light in a way that, as our current understanding of the laws of physics has it, is impossible.
Yeah.
And so you have this strange idea that the relativistic effects of gravity are important in the plot. But the relativistic effects of faster-than-light travel, which you might expect would be mind-blowing, don't enter into it. But I suppose that's just for narrative convenience, right? I mean, you can't have some characters go off on a journey and then they come back, but subjectively billions of years have passed for Gateway, because if that was the case, the story wouldn't work out at all.
Yeah, definitely. And that was something that I had down to ask you about. Mm-hmm. I think they do kind of lampshade it a little bit and mention that there's a wormhole of some kind.
Right, yeah, that's what... But then they talk about being in Tau space, and I don't know what that is. That sounds made up to me.
Yeah. It's hyperspace, but a different name. Yeah, or warp space, like in Star Trek.
Right? Yeah.
Where they warp space around the ship, so it's not actually exceeding the speed of light.
Interesting, Get Out. I mean...
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's, as far as we know, mathematically, you can't have anything like a traversable wormhole. I read some bizarre article the other day that was saying you could have a wormhole that you could get matter through, providing you have an infinite amount of anti-gravity or something. And as soon as someone says that, you just think, well, this just sounds like science fiction rather than science fact.
Right. I think I saw that. No, they were talking about exotic matter. You need a bunch of exotic matter to open it up.
But the thing is, I mean, if you're going to allow yourself to have stuff that violates the laws of physics as we know them, then you might as well have some stuff that can move faster than the speed of light, right? I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
It's just MacGuffin, isn't it?
Yeah, so I wanted to talk to you, like, kind of your perspective as a science fiction fan and as a scientist. You know, what do you think of faster than light travel in fiction? Do you like it, or is it just something that you see as necessary, or what?
So you probably know that there was this movement in sci-fi called mundane sci-fi, right?
I'm not sure I've heard it termed that way.
Okay, well, I can tell you about it then, and I'll probably get it all wrong. But
all right.
There was a series of sci-fi authors recently, some years ago, who said, let's not have anything that can't happen scientifically in our sci-fi novels. So you can have contact with alien civilizations, perhaps, but it has to be limited to... you know, X, Y, and Z. You have to have signals traveling at light speed. You have to have... So the Forever War might actually be quite a good example, because I don't think anything in there does violate the laws of physics necessarily. They travel near the speed of light, but it takes them a long time to do it, and relativistic effects are taken into account and so on. But mundane sci-fi, I think, goes even further than that and says, well, we know there's no alien civilizations close to us that can communicate, so let's not have that either. And it says no faster than light travel, no time travel, nothing like that. And you can write books within that framework, but I don't necessarily see that it's better than writing them outside of that framework. I feel like sci-fi isn't just about showing people the best of science and the aspects of physics that interest you. That's a great thing that it can do. But what it's really about is holding up a mirror to society. And you can use all kinds of devices to do that. And, you know, frankly, if you're going to... If you want to write books where you restrict the narrative possibilities to the possible, that's fine, but you don't have to do that.
Yeah,
and so I don't mind faster than light travel. If it means a few extra people on the internet find out I'm a physicist and say, "Can we go through wormholes to go faster than the speed of light?" You know, I'm fine explaining that to them. I think it's good that we have this fascination, and you know, there are lots of things that were thought to be impossible that have turned out not to be impossible. So. I think people should keep their imagination open about faster than light travel. What do you think?
Yeah, I tend to agree that it's in some ways a plot contrivance and almost pushes some science fiction over into the realm of fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's the kind of thing where I like to take a broad umbrella for science fiction, where you have on one hand you have The Martian and, you know, Red Mars and, you know, the nuts and bolts, hard science fiction, sticking with reality here as much as possible. The Martian has some inaccuracies, of course. And on the other side, you have things that veer towards fantasy. Even something like Lord of Light, which was one that I did recently, you know, it's using technology to essentially do magic. In the story.
And so, of course, Arthur C. Clarke has a very famous quotation about that.
Yes, definitely. So yeah, I like to have a smorgasbord of science fiction.
Completely.
Sometimes I'm in the mood for a hard science fiction and other times not so much. So,
I mean, yeah, I agree. It's good to have all sorts of perspectives. By no means am I saying, you know, I think when you introduce things like faster than light travel and especially time travel into your books, they provide you with a lot of examples narratively of what you might call the telephone paradox, which is you can't do murder mysteries so much anymore, or you can't do thrillers because why aren't people ringing the police? Why aren't they calling for help? That kind of thing. So that sort of technology, when you introduce new technology into old narratives, it kind of ruins them. And time travel is the worst example of that, because if you have some sort of paradox-free time travel, it's like, well, why don't they use it to solve their problem?
Yeah.
And sometimes they do, and sometimes they invent rules so that they selectively can't. And quite often your hero has to be deprived of his time machine or something for there to be any narrative tension at all. But
That's why on thriller television all the time you have somebody trying to make a phone call and their cell phone has no signal or is out of battery.
Yeah, yeah. No one charges their phones.
Yeah. No, I also really like in science fiction when they want to play with something like either near light speed travel or faster than light speed, where they say, you know, there was a discovery after our first contact with aliens or something, where they give you some plausible, not nuts and bolts, hard science fiction explanation, but something that makes you go, oh, okay, so we figured that out now. I can accept that and move on.
And in Gateway, that is kind of how it works, because obviously you just have this idea that the Heechee are ridiculously advanced and we don't understand how any of their technology works. And it's undiscovered physics that they're exploiting.
Yes.
And I think we can believe just about that there's potentially enough undiscovered things in the world out there that such things may be possible for super advanced species.
Yeah. I think you had a recent episode on aliens where it was just the first half of an episode where you were talking about talking about the Drake equation and like there's got to be other civilizations out there. But this Gateway has kind of one of the possibilities, right? That there are other aliens out there, but they may have died off by now. Just because the way civilizations rise and fall, the fact of the distances involved in space travel and the amount of time that a civilization takes to rise up and then fall makes it really unlikely that you're ever going to cross over while you're both still alive.
Yes, absolutely.
Which is, it's depressing.
In some ways it is. Of course, if you believe that any species that would have the motivation to explore might also be voracious predators, maybe it's reassuring. But
that's true.
You're right. We have to. It's a four-dimensional problem, right? We've got to intersect in time as well as in space. And it might be easy for you to imagine. Well, it's not even easy to imagine intersecting in space, right? I mean, the nearest planet is outside our solar system is 4 light years away. So at the very least, it's going to take people, you know, of order 4, 8, 10 years for signals to get there and back. There's even a plan actually, which is discussed in I think my most recent episode, to send spaceships to the nearest planet. And the way they're going to do this is they've got a tiny, well, they don't have, but they're going to make, hopefully, a tiny fleet of iPhone-sized spaceships. And they can accelerate them using a massive series of lasers. Because when laser photons hit an object, they transfer momentum to it, right? And so they feel that they can use this pulsed lasers to accelerate this fleet of tiny spaceships to about 0.2 times the speed of light, so about 20% the speed of light. And they get to this nearest planet, Proxima Centauri b, in 20 years, and then they would send signals back. So within 30 years or so of project initiation, you'd have data from this other planet. And so it's possibly feasible that this century we might send probes to the nearest planet. But I mean, if life is only in one of a billion planets, then your chances of finding it in space are very small. But since there are trillions of planets, if life is in only one in a billion planets, there will be thousands of millions of civilizations out there. So that's why I think there's life out there somewhere. I think it's a numbers game. If you're going to believe that there's only one civilization, us, amongst the trillions of civilizations that could exist on the trillions of planets that could potentially bear some form of life. I think if you're going to say that these two huge numbers, the number that's like the number of planets and the number that is the probability of intelligent life arising, exactly cancel to give you one, then you're basically saying that we were created by God or a simulation or something else, because it seems so wildly unlikely to me that we would be the only ones. Yet the only explanation then, in my mind, would be that there is a creator. And I just don't think that's true. Right. So I'm forced to conclude there's aliens out there. And we're just very unlikely to find them.
Well, I'll have to, and maybe you can send me you can tell me which episodes you, I know the Drake equation one, you talked about that at some length, but I think then in one of your, in the Alien Invasion, let's see, how's it pronounced?
Teotwauki. Yeah, the end of the world as we know it.
Yes. You talked a little more about that. Now, for me, I am a religious believer, and but on the other hand, I also strongly believe that there's other life out there.
I
agree with you that if it's just one, then it does kind of strongly hint at those two possibilities you mentioned. Seems like too much of a coincidence otherwise, but I don't think that's, I wouldn't take that as evidence for a creator, really. More data about what's actually out there.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that a creator implies one civilization, but I do think that one civilization implies a creator. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I get it. Let's see. I wanted to talk about the gravitational effects because that really does have one of the more heartrending parts of the book. So do you want to talk about that?
Absolutely, yes. So as you talk about, this book is building up a sense of profound dread. We know that something is wrong with Bob. We start to get into the more normal Freudian analysis of how was his relationship with his mother? His father died when he was small and wasn't there for him. Did these have impacts on his psyche? And earlier in the book, it's revealed that he has a troubled past. He had a nervous breakdown, I think, before he won the lottery and got the money to go to Gateway. So you know that he's already mentally fragile. And when he's on Gateway, he meets another prospector there who initially is teaching him the ropes of how to use the Hechi ships, which, based on human understanding at the time, is we don't know, but if you press this button, it goes.
Right.
And this woman, Clara, is his love interest in the book. And at the end of the book, so the book follows his various prospecting trips. Let's see. The first one, they go on a long prospecting trip and he finds nothing and they return. The second one, he goes out by himself and he finds an alternative route to another gateway, Gateway 2. But this had already been discovered, so this was a bust. And he gets mad and he smashes the ship.
And, yes.
and luckily manages to escape prosecution from the Gateway authorities, who seem like a right bunch of mean people, to be honest, because if you can't pay the tax for food, they throw you out of the airlock.
I liked what it said in there that you will be asked to leave the station, and a ship being there to take you off the station is not a prerequisite for leaving the station.
Yeah. Frederick Pohl has one of the most dry sense of humors I can think of in sci-fi authors. Sometimes you'll read a joke and you don't even realize that it's a joke until about 5 minutes later.
Yeah.
And then you find yourself laughing at it.
Yes.
So he's running out of money, and as you said, he's facing this psychological tension. Do I go out there? Do I not go out there? But obviously knowing that either he goes out there or resigns himself to his rubbish life. So he's between this rock and a hard place. And they go out on a final expedition that's been specially arranged by Gateway Authority because it's incredibly dangerous. And, you know, they need two of the armor, the biggest ships that they can have, because I think they've discovered something about the navigation system, the controls that tell them that this is a particularly dangerous destination. But they believe that there'll be something of immense value there as well. So they send this expedition and they say, we'll give you $10 million if you succeed, which is enough to set them all up for life. And so he goes with many people, and one of them is this Clara woman who is his love interest. And they eventually arrive at their destination, and they are very close to the event horizon of a black hole.
Right.
And at this point, you begin to realize what this big traumatic event was that he's been trying and failing to talk about with Siegfried throughout the whole book.
Yeah.
Because they come up with a scheme. I don't know about the physics of this scheme. I think it might work, but their scheme is essentially to put the two ships together, to jettison one of them with as much force as possible. And that will give the other ship enough force, enough momentum to escape the event horizon of the black hole. And
start back home.
And start back home, yeah. So in terms of the physics of this, I mean, who knows? Because you also have to rely on the Hechi magic technology that allows you to travel faster than the speed of light.
Right.
So it seems like you could probably get a kick from kicking the other ship into the black hole. And if they're telling me that's enough for the Hechi technology to escape, I'll believe that, because otherwise it's a boring book where everyone gets sucked into a black hole in the end.
I was thinking of it as analogous to Hawking radiation.
Right, right.
Where you have the... I can't even remember now how to describe it. You can do it though.
So I think in terms of Hawking radiation, you have two virtual particles either side of the event horizon. Is that right? And
yeah, that's right. And they would normally annihilate.
They would normally annihilate, but there's something about the energetics of the situation that allows one of them to be sucked into the black hole and lose gravitational potential energy as it goes towards, you know, what we assume is a very dense point or possibly a singularity in the heart of the black hole. Mm-hmm. And as it loses that energy, the other one gains it. And this is how black holes shoot out the Hawking radiation, by right. almost pulling these virtual particles into being on the other side of the black hole. And so yeah. those particles are ejected, and this is why black holes eventually evaporate with tragic consequences for our universe, because it means that, you know, if the end state of many stars is black holes, then eventually even the black holes that are at least interesting and providing energetics and so on, they too will evaporate given long enough, and the universe will just be a soup of emptiness and heavily expanded, ultra sparse particles and so on, and nothing very interesting will happen. But yeah, you're right. There is yeah. an analogy in the mechanism to this, the idea that there's a pair, and one of the pair escapes the black hole and the other one's sucked in.
Mm-hmm.
And so for Robinette and his crew, including Clara, they're scrambling around trying to jettison the ship with all of the equipment in and leave in the ship with all the humans in. Mm-hmm. And in the chaos, someone hits a button. Bob can't remember. Was it him? Was it one of the other people in the ship? It's one of these traumatic events that I think in human psychology tends to become quite blurry. But something yeah. happens. The ships are detached, and the one that he's accidentally in is the one that is able to escape. And the one with the other nine members of his crew, including the woman he loves, mm-hmm. is jettisoned into the black hole. And this is the right. huge traumatic event that is driving his character and his psyche throughout the book. And he explains to Siegfried right at the end of the book that one of the reasons this is so terrible is because of the gravitational time dilation in the black hole. So as you know, as you approach the event horizon of the black hole, time passes more slowly for you than it does on the outside world. So mm-hmm. subjectively for you, time passes at a normal rate. A minute is just a minute by your clock. But your clock drifts out of sync with the clock that is not influenced by gravity. And we actually see these gravitational time dilation effects literally on Earth from people going to the top of mountains and at the bottom of mountains. This has been measured. When you're at yeah. the top of a mountain, mm-hmm. the gravitational force on you is less because you're further from the Earth's center. When you're at the bottom, you're closer to the Earth's center. The gravitational field is stronger. And that difference in gravitational fields mean that by a few nanoseconds or something, the person on the top of the mountain's clock is running slower by the people below. But it actually gets really dramatic when you're near this black hole. And so for Clara mm. and Bob and so on, Clara experiences perhaps a minute drifting into this black hole, only beginning to realize that she's doomed. And that, for Bob, is right. his entire lifetime back on Earth, you yeah. know, thousands of years. And when you actually reach that singularity, the event horizon, I believe the relative time diverges to infinity, to the extent that from the perspective of people on the outside, you almost never cross over. You know, an instant for you mm-hmm. is an infinite amount of time on the outside world. So it's wild. She'll never, from his perspective, yeah. fall into the black hole and die. She will always... Right. The He-Chi ships must be made of some pretty stern stuff because they seem to be able to resist the tidal forces of the black hole. But again, we hand wave right. away that. So he's saying, you know, how can I live with this, knowing that for her, every moment is the moment of my betrayal or accident or escape? And that yeah. is one of the things that traumatizes him so much about the experience.
Yeah, because it's not so much that he thinks he feels responsible for having killed her. It's that he's still killing her, really, yeah. at this moment.
At every moment for the rest of his life. It's not something yeah. you can get over because it's still occurring. And I thought that was a really beautiful yeah. use of the... gravitational relativistic time dilation. It was very imaginative yeah. by the author. And do you mind if I quote the last lines of the book? Because they stuck with me, and I'm sure they stuck with you as well.
Sure.
So as we talk about, he's been talking to this robot psychotherapist who's finally wheedled out of him the source of his buried trauma. And throughout the book, he's been yelling at the robot psychotherapist saying, "You don't understand, you don't feel emotions, you're a machine." And they say to each other, so the psychotherapist says, It is out in the open where you can let it work for you, not buried away where it can only harm you. That is what I am for, Bob, to bring your feelings out where you can use them. Even the bad feelings, says Bob. Guilt, fear, pain, envy. Guilt, fear, pain, envy. The motivators, the modifiers, the qualities that I, Bob, do not have except in a hypothetical sense, when I make a paradigm and assign them to myself to study. There was another pause. I have a funny feeling about it. Siegfried's pauses are usually either to give me time to let something sink in, or to permit him to compute some more complex chain of argument about me. This time I think it is neither of them. He is thinking, but not about me. And at last he says, so now I can answer what you asked me, Bob. Asked you? What was that? You asked me, do you call this living? And I answer, yes. It is exactly what I call living. And in my best hypothetical sense, I envy it very much. So that's about the biggest spoiler I can give to all of the listeners, given that I've read the last bit of the book. But I think that's such a beautiful piece of writing.
Yeah, it's very kind of wistful at the end there. And you feel like Siegfried is more than just an AI in some way.
Absolutely. But also, you know, he's touching on this this fact of human psychology that I think we have come to accept, that is that negative emotions are necessary for our growth and our development, and a part of life that you shouldn't shy away from, but should embrace insofar as you can without being destroyed by them, I suppose.
Right. Oh, that reminds me of Forbidden Planet, the consequences of getting rid of the negative emotions.
What happens there? You'll have to tell me about it.
Oh, I don't want to spoil it.
Okay, right.
Suffice it to say, Monsters of the Id.
Yeah, okay, well, that does...
It's a science fiction movie that is very much of its time, but definitely worth watching.
Okay, I mean, I guess in a guilt-free world, well, you know, we can see what happens to certain individuals when they don't seem to show any shame or guilt for their actions, right?
Yes. Yeah, there's kind of two sides to it, bottling it all up and just letting everything be expressed.
Yeah, yeah.
One thing that I liked was Bob's word for aliens that we've never heard of.
Dlugblatches, yeah.
Yes. A word I just made up to describe a kind of life we've never heard of that doesn't generate methane in its gut, but eats people.
Yeah.
Because if they come out of their mission on the other side of it and there's a planet, then they take readings, right? And if they don't read methane, then they think, okay, there's no life there. So we don't need to worry about collecting any samples or anything like that for study. But he's saying, well, what about dlugblatches though?
Well, I mean, I was speaking my last show, I interviewed a guy, Rafael Alves Batista, who is an astrobiologist, is one of the strings to his bow, I guess. And he's looking for life on alien planets. And all they can do really is look for the signatures of life as we know it on Earth. But in some ways, you can believe that there might be other forms of life that don't leave the same signatures. Perfectly believable there. And so maybe, you know, the dlugblatches exist, but we can't find them using our current methods. And he also did a wonderful study, actually, about the resilience of life to astrophysical events. Because there used to be this theory for the resolution of Fermi paradox. I don't want to go into it too much, but the Fermi paradox is like, if there's life everywhere, why can't we talk to any of them? And one of the resolutions is perhaps that there are events, astrophysical events like supernovae, like gamma ray bursts or meteorite strikes that periodically destroy civilizations and sterilize areas of space. So we're less likely to sync up with civilizations in time because they're just getting wiped out by asteroids, you know, fairly frequently. Mm-hmm. But he showed with his study that at least for the Earth, there's actually not many astrophysical events that could destroy us. Providing we don't destroy ourselves, we should expect that there would be life on the planet at least until the sun expands in about 1 billion years.
Yeah.
So life is probably quite persistent. But yeah, I think that's the best thing about this book, and I'm sure you'll agree, is just this concept of spinning the dice and ending up anywhere.
Yes. Yeah, because I was when I was reading about when Bob first takes up with Clara, they find out that they have very similar reluctance to go out on a mission, and since she has already, I think she's been out on one that paid out fairly well.
That's right,
and so she kind of has the luxury of having Bob as a kept man, and so they enable each other to not go out again. And I can absolutely see that I have some of those tendencies in my own life, a tendency to go, you know what? No, my current job is fine. I don't need to look for something else. And to not challenge myself, you know, to not do the frightening thing. And this book definitely made me think about that.
Yeah. And, you know, perhaps you can view it as a metaphor for the human experience, because it is, like we say, on Earth, he has this choice. Do I stick with my secure, boring, terrible life of, you know, toil in the mines and then drinking to forget of a weekend? Or do I attempt this, you know, win the lottery and attempt this wild, crazy event, you know? Or, you know, when he wins the money, he acknowledges that he could set himself up with a fairly comfortable life, or he could take the risk, gamble it all and go for something a lot bigger. And I think that's the choice that a lot of people feel in their own lives when it comes to picking careers and so on. And of course, sometimes you don't have a choice, but and our choices are never quite as dramatic as going to a big bank of spaceships and hitting a random destination button. But it can feel like that sometimes.
Yeah, and you know, there is kind of a conservative streak that makes us weigh consequences of taking an action more heavily against the benefits of taking the action. And so you look at something mundane like the US not switching to the metric system. I'm not sure what the negative consequences would be, but they must be so huge that that we've stayed with the imperial measurements. Mm-hmm. And it baffles me. As an engineering major, it was very frustrating having to learn both. But or even something like in your course of study, right? Atmospheric physics and climate and all that kind of stuff, right? The potential of moving off of fossil fuels and the unknowns there seem to outweigh the benefits of actually cleaning up the environment.
Well, it's a strange one, isn't it? Because I think that one of the reasons we found dealing with climate change so difficult is that it actually extends, people believe at least, that it extends outside of their lifespan. I think people are motivated by the desire to avoid regretting decisions, which is kind of what we're talking about here. But of course, if you believe that there won't be negative consequences until after you die, which is certainly the case for some of the political leadership at the moment, then you can quite happily kick the can down the road because you know you'll never regret it either way.
Some things advance one funeral at a time. So.
We'll have to see. but it is strange. I think it does. One of the things this book certainly does is it makes you wonder, how would I react under this circumstance? Would I have the guts to go to Gateway? Would I? And of course, all of these people, they go out on a mission. And when you're playing Russian roulette, you spin the chamber and you hear a click. You know, you've just risked death and survived. And then they have to spin the chamber again because, you know, either you stay on Gateway. There's no point staying there. There's not much to do there. The nightlife is apparently not very good. You either go out again or you return home a failure. And they don't seem like anyone has anything on Earth worth returning to. Earth is portrayed as a very desolate place.
Yeah. One of the other interesting things was the experience of the people aboard the missions, but not, you know, kind of having that open-ended nature to it, right? Where you don't know how far out it's going to go. And being in close quarters with people that you may not even like, for all that time with the looming risk of, well, we might all have to suicide one at a time in order for anyone to make it back. And then just in that cramped environment, in that awful, smelly, terrible, limited sanitation kind of environment, that kind of thing makes me think, I'm not sure that I could go out on a mission, come back and think, I'll do that again.
Sure. And I mean, the tension that builds up when they're waiting for turnaround, when they're waiting to know how long the mission will be, is quite well portrayed. It reminds me of a couple of things.
Yeah.
One is, I'm sure you heard about it, there was that recent experiment where they were testing human psychological capacity to go to Mars. And so they shut a whole bunch of people up in a lander and simulated what their communications with the outside world would be like with, you know, the the quality and all this sort of thing. And they shut them together for 7 months or however long they've calculated the Martian voyage would be to see if they all went mad and ate each other. And I don't think they did, but no. But they missed some interesting news stories on the outside. But
yeah, some of them probably wanted to go back in.
Yes, can we actually get this thing to go to Mars, please? But but yes, so I think the psychological effects of confined travel is something. And then also, again, it brings us back to this analogy of early exploration days, because when you read accounts of something like the Magellan Voyage, who was, as you probably know, the first man to circumnavigate the Earth, and at that time everyone was looking for a passage to India because they had all of the expensive spices and so on, and you normally had to get them go through some torturous route that went via the Middle East, and they got taxed and all this terrible thing. So everyone was looking for a passage to India. And that's why the West Indies Caribbean is called the West Indies, because they believed that they'd found the west of India. And so in Magellan's case, in that initial voyage, he goes from Portugal, pursued by the King of Spain after having ripped him off or something. He goes down south around the coast of South America, which they knew was there, but he didn't know that you could go around it in a boat necessarily. He gets to the other side, through the Straits of Magellan, which is an incredibly torturous voyage, and he thinks, marvellous, we must be very close to India. And of course, if you think of your geography, he had the entire Pacific Ocean yet to cross. So he has no idea how long that voyage is going to be. And he's meeting all sorts of strange civilizations along the way. You know, some of them are savages. There's risks. There's illness on the ships, and the crewmates die and so on. And of the people who make it on that first circumnavigation, I think there was like a survival rate of something like 10%. And they had 10 boats and they came back with one. But that boat was so loaded with spices and goods and so on from India that hadn't been taxed that they all became millionaires and they were set up for life. So the gateway phenomenon has happened on Earth. It's just that it happened 500 years ago and doesn't happen so much anymore.
Yeah, and so it kind of, to me, I'm having grown up on Star Trek and Star Wars, where there was interplanetary travel all over the place and aliens everywhere. There's a frustration, right, to me that like I would like to see that exploration period happen again. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see an alien civilization discovered.
It would be amazing,
even if it's just the remnants of a civilization.
I mean, it would be wild. And and again, I think it does change how you view everything, really, doesn't it? Because now I think, as we said, both of us have this suspicion that somewhere out there, connected to us by our gravitational field that extends through all of space and so on, perhaps with their telescopes pointed at us, silently observing, there are aliens, alien life, some kind of civilization that we can't find. But knowing that for sure is very different to suspecting it.
Yep. Well, anything else, Thomas? Anything you want to talk about the book before we sign off?
The only other thing I would say about the book is that there are a series of sequels that go more into the world of the Heechee and so on. I haven't read any of them. I keep remembering, because I only found this out. I read the book first, probably 10 years ago. I only found out about the sequels a year or two ago when I was lending the book to a friend. It's one of those books I've had about 7 copies of now, because I always give it to someone, say, you've got to read this book, and then they never give it back. And obviously I have to read it myself, so I get another copy. So I found out that there are a series of sequels that go more into the mythology. And I don't know anything about them, whether they even have the same main character or what happens. But so I can't recommend them to the listeners, but I'm certainly going to read them at some point. And hopefully they'll be just as enjoyable, and maybe we'll find out more about the civilization and whether there's contact with other alien civilizations in the future. And if it's just another fun go on the merry-go-round of different possibilities, I think that would be fun enough.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I was kind of hoping that you had read some of them so I could pick your brain about if they were worth it.
Well, so we'll have to come back and do a sequel to this conversation. Down,
All right. Well, I think it's about time to sign off then.
Sure, absolutely.
So where can people find you?
Right. So the physics podcast that I've managed to mention a couple of times so far, you can find at the memorable website of www.physicspodcast.com. I'm also on Twitter, tweeting mostly about the show, occasionally about things that I can't not tweet about. That's at physicspod. And the other thing that people might want to do is I freelance write articles for Singularity Hub, which is a website that deals with science and technology. And you can normally find stuff that I've written there under my name, which is Thomas Hornigold. And so if anyone's interested in what I think about climate change or green energy or robotics and artificial intelligence, I've usually got an article on there about every other week. That's about it, I think.
Nice. I'll make sure to put links to all that in the show notes. So I think you mentioned that in a podcast episode, right, about the writing?
Yes.
All right. Well, I really want to thank you for doing this. This has been a lot of fun. And you are not my first international guest. I had someone on from Canada,
okay.
But certainly first across the pond. So I really appreciate you coming on.
We're transcontinental. It's an international show.
Absolutely.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Yeah. And maybe down the line, we'll have you back on to do something else when I start getting repeat guests.
Sure. That would be great.
Okay. Well, again, thanks so much. And talk to you later, hopefully. Bye.
Bye.
Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Thomas, and I highly recommend that you go check out his podcast, Physical Attraction. It's a very cool concept, and he's, like he mentioned, he's done some interviews about possible ends of the world scenarios, and also just his typical one where it's, as he says, discussing physics one chat up line at a time, which I think is great. So definitely worth listening to. And I will put links to all of Thomas's social media and website and that kind of stuff in the show notes. Before I sign off, of course, I want to invite you to get in touch with us on social media. The username is Hugo's Podcast. Check us out on Goodreads. That's how you can kind of get a hint of what I'm going to be talking about next. And if you want to send me an email, it's feedback@hugospodcast.com. And if you want to leave us a review wherever you want to leave it, that would be great. Appreciate that. And one more thing before I sign off, actually, is I want to tell you about Zencastr, which is the tool that I use for recording the podcast. It's really, really convenient for if you have a podcast where you have guests, because Zencastr allows you to just send them a link. They click the link, it automatically will save their audio on their side and upload it at the end to your Dropbox. So it saves you the trouble of having somebody pull up Audacity or have some kind of app that they have to download. They really just pull up a browser and rock and roll. Keeps you from having to do anything like a clap sync also, because the tracks start recording at the same time. So it really makes having a guest on your podcast really, really simple. So definitely check out Zencastr. It's at zencastr.com. I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. And that'll do it for this episode. So until next time, talk to you later.